that is, I consider some relativistic quantum fields, so there will always be some h bar and c in my equations, even though sometimes I set them to one, but they are there. And these relativistic quantum fields, they start off in a vacuum state. And then there will be some external conditions which are sort of extremely strong. And then it can happen that these fields do not stay in a vacuum state, but instead you create particle pairs, or these external conditions create particle pairs. So first example is the Sauter-Schwinger effect. Here's a picture of Schwinger, by the way, where due to a very strong electric field, if you take the quantum electrodynamics vacuum and you apply a very strong electric field, then you can pull out electron-positron pairs if the field is strong enough. And then you have these creation of particle pairs. Hawking radiation, that means the evaporation of a black hole, there the electric field is replaced by gravitational fields, but again, the gravitational field is so strong near the horizon that you pull out pairs of particles. One of these particles goes up to infinity and gives you the black hole evaporation, and the other pair then falls into the black hole and you cannot observe it, but there are always two of them. Then we have, oh yeah, here's Hawking, and here's Bill Unruh, also sitting over there. The Unruh effect, which just tells you that instead, if you replace the gravitational field by an acceleration, the Unruh effect tells you that if you take the usual Minkowski vacuum, where I would say, there's no particles in it, and then you consider an accelerated observer, he would disagree, so he would see particles. Then another of these effects, which I think I also put into the list since it's very similar here, is the dynamical Casimir effect. You probably know the usual static Casimir effect, where you have just two, say, perfectly conducting neutral, say, parallel plates in vacuum. And in classical theory, if you have neutral parallel plates, nothing happens. But in quantum theory, you have the quantum fluctuations, and in between, they are different from outside. So in quantum field theory, the two plates actually attract. This has been measured. But the same theory also predicts that if you now don't have the plates sitting there but moving, that you could also create pairs of photons out of the vacuum. And that hasn't been seen yet, even though there is some nice experiment about some analog system for that. And the final example I'm considering here is cosmological particle creation, where the vacuum is then ripped apart by the strong or fast expansion of the universe. So you have the initial vacuum, no particles, then the universe expands, and due to the strong rapid expansion, the vacuum is ripped apart, and again, you produce pairs of particles. So they look very different, these effects on the first side, but as I explained to you, in all cases, you have your initial vacuum, quantum vacuum fluctuations, you have some external conditions. In quantum optics, we call this a squeezing, and then you produce entangled pairs of particles. And none of these effects has been really conclusively seen yet in the lab, so they are all predictions, but we have some indirect signatures. For example, as I told you, for the dynamical Casimir effect, I'm going to speak about it a bit later on, they did a nice experiment where instead of the vacuum, you had now a waveguide. And instead of the mirror, you have some time-dependent reflecting boundary conditions, which has been changed in time. So they didn't actually change the mirror, they just changed the boundary condition. And then they saw something like this dynamical Casimir effect. Or for cosmological particle creation, we also have something that is, if you look at the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background, here's the picture from the WMAP satellite. And then you, according to our present understanding, you trace them back in time. The origin for these little grizzles here, that exactly comes from some cosmological particle creation during the very early epoch of our universe, that is during inflation. But that's, if you believe in inflation and if you believe in everything we sort of think about cosmology, then this is an indirect signature, but we haven't seen it, of course, as a real hand-on experiment. Okay, so now, since we haven't seen them, can we do something about seeing something similar in the lab? And here, now I'm going through these effects. Most of the time, I will be spending on these two, and then just mention the remaining three a bit briefly. Okay, so let's start with the Sauter-Schwinger effect. And there, I think, since not everybody will be familiar with it, let me start very, very slowly and first introduce you to the concept of this Dirac C. You of course, know the Schrödinger equation. Oh, yeah, Schrödinger, by the way. It's this one. This is a non-relativistic, this is the equation for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And you, of course, also know, if you now do the usual replacement, that you say d by dt is energy, d by dx is momentum, then you get the usual non-relativistic energy-momentum relation from the Schrödinger equation. But of course, you know, once the electrons start to move with the speed of light, that doesn't work anymore. So you have to have a relativistic description, and that's then the Dirac equation. Here's Dirac, where d by dt and d by dx are now combined into a space-time derivatives. Here are the Dirac matrices, and the potential here is now encoded into a four potential over there, and the mass is here. And then if you take the Dirac equation and do the same thing, d by dt is energy, d by dx is momentum, then as you would expect, as we should have, you get the relativistic, oops, why is this shaking? Okay. You have the relativistic energy-momentum relation. So here's energy, here's momentum, here's the mass, and then the potential from up here. But the point is, if you look at this equation, you see you get two sets of solutions in the relativistic case. That is, you have positive solutions and negative solutions. So if you forget the potential for a while, then you have energies which start with mc squared, the rest mass, and go upwards. And negative energies which start with minus mc squared and go downwards. That just comes out of the equation that are solutions. They are possible. And then Dirac thought, yeah, why? That's a bit strange. Since if I would say here, I have an electron over there, and then it's propagating, it shouldn't happen that the electron then decays down here, emits a photon, and maybe decays further and further. That's strange. If an electron propagates through vacuum, it just stays there. It doesn't decay. And then his idea was, okay, all these negative states, we just fill them up. These are fermions. And if these states are all filled up, due to the Pauli principle, you cannot fill them again. So if you have an electron over here, it doesn't decay, since here everything is already occupied. And then in this picture, the vacuum would be just a state where everything here is full and everything here is empty. An electron would then be that one of these states here is filled in addition. But you could also think, okay, what happens if I take this one out, and then you have a hole here, and this hole is then a positron. Oops, sorry. So in fact, with this equation, he already foresaw the existence of positrons even before they were experimentally detected. Okay, now let's see what happens if you apply an additional electric field. So here we have our Dirac C without electric field. And now if you switch on the electric field, you can write this as a potential, Q times E times X, say electric field goes in X direction. And then you see everything there is tilted. The whole Dirac C is tilted, and also the other levels are tilted. And then you see, okay, look, here, if I take this electron out of the Dirac C, and I go a bit to the left, then I see it has the same energy as this electron here on the positive side. So classically, this one, this range is forbidden. But you know, in quantum theory, if there's something forbidden, you can still sort of tunnel through it. And the same happens here. So the electron from here can tunnel through this forbidden region over there and appear on this side. And if this tunneling happens, then suddenly here an electron appears on the positive side. So there's suddenly an electron. And here on this side, a hole appears, so there's a positron. That means if this appears, then you created an electron-positron pair out of the vacuum due to this electric field. And, oh, sorry, yeah. Here's Schwinger, here's Heisenberg. Unfortunately, I didn't find a picture of Sauter yet, but Schwinger wasn't the first one who discovered this, so there were other people, among them Heisenberg and Euler. So if you have a strong enough electric field in the vacuum, then you should produce electron-positron pairs, even though the field is totally static, so not time-dependent. So why haven't we seen this effect yet? In order to answer this question, let's look at the probability. How likely is it that the particle from here to there tunnels through? And let's make a very rough estimate. Just say, okay, I take my textbook equation for non-relativistic tunneling. It's not quite correct, but for simple estimate. And you know, if you look at your quantum mechanics textbook, tunneling is always exponentially suppressed. And in the exponent, you have the length to be tunneled through, the mass, and the potential barrier over h bar. Okay, the tunneling length can be calculated easily from here to there. So you need to gain enough energy to overcome this gap of 2 mc squared in this electric field. So the length is basically 2 mc squared over q times E. And then we need the potential barrier. That's a bit more complicated. First of all, this is not really non-relativistic. You know, we have mc squared flying around. And the potential is also not constant. So, but just let's make a very, very rough estimate and say, this is something like mc squared, also the typical scale of this height here. And we plug this in, then we get such an expression. And this very rough estimate already comes very close to the exact result. If you do the whole calculation exactly, not in this very rough way I did, then instead of the factor of 4, you get a factor of pi, but otherwise it's already okay. So if you do the calculation exactly, this gives you the tunneling probability. You have such an exponent for this effect to happen. And then we can look at this equation a bit and say, okay, now let's try to make a Taylor expansion with respect to the charge Q. That would be the usual thing. If you have a QED effect and you want to derive Feynman diagrams, then you make a Taylor expansion in Q. But here you see you have e to the minus 1 over Q. So there is no Taylor expansion in Q. It doesn't work. That means this effect cannot be seen within usual perturbation theory if you go to arbitrary high but finite order. So we can write down Feynman diagrams up to the 10th order. You will not see this effect. It's really non-perturbative, which also means it's a bit difficult to calculate. And then to see why this effect hasn't been seen yet, what one does is take all the natural constants here and combine it into a critical field strength. And then if you plug in all these numbers, you see you get a huge field, 10 to the 18 volts per meter. And that sort of explains why we haven't seen this effect yet, since we have not been able to produce such fields in the lab. If you want to produce such a field with a laser focus, for example, so focusing a laser field that there is just the E field remaining, then that corresponds to an extremely high intensity, 10 to the 29. And if you know a little bit about lasers, you know this is far too much. So nobody is able to reach that. There are some ideas about for building extremely strong lasers, and they envisage something like 10 to the 26 watts per square centimeter. Problem is, this is still three orders of magnitude away. And then remember, this is in the exponent. So if we insert now this exponential suppression, you get a probability of 10 to the minus 61. So we probably won't see this in the lifetime of the universe. But it doesn't look so bad. For example, if the experimentalists were able to get to 10 to the 27 here, that's just one order of magnitude more, then you would have a factor of 10 in the intensity. That's sort of a factor of 3 in the field strength. So this would be a factor of 3 bigger. And then instead of 10 to the minus 60, would have 10 to the minus 20. That's still a very tiny number. But on the other hand, if you look at such a laser focus, such a laser focus is huge. If you look at from an electronic point of view, so the typical electronic, the scale for the electrons and positrons is the Compton wavelength. And the laser wavelength is huge compared to that. So this micrometer, the laser. And that extends in all three spatial directions and also in the time direction. So you have a huge four-volume factor in front of the exponential, which is roughly 10 to the 22. So if you would be able to get to 10 to the 27 here, then you had exponent of 10 to the minus 20 and a prefactor of 10 to the 20, then you would be able to see it effect. But still, the experimentalists told me that this is probably the best they can do at the moment. So, or not at the moment, but in the next couple of years. So it's a bit hard to see. So that's the idea. Can we make some enhancement for this effect? It's one idea to see it. And it turns out there are some ideas to get an enhancement. And one of them which we worked on is this quantum optics assisted tunneling. So the basic idea can be described in this way. This is the usual effect. So tunneling from the electron tunnels from here to there. And the problem is this tunneling way is so long, the probability is so small, we cannot see it. So maybe we can help and say, consider this, that we have an additional little pulse, so some additional time dependence or plane wave field, which lifts the electron up a bit here. And then the remaining way to tunnel is much shorter. This is sort of very pictorial picture, but it turns out it works. Oh, unfortunately, one cannot see this. So this is one of the pulses we considered. So here the blue, this is a very strong and slow pulse. And then, unfortunately, you can't see it. So here there are supposed to be a little red dip, so a much weaker but faster pulse. And if you combine the two, you get something like this, that the red pulse lifts them up. And then the remaining way to tunnel is much shorter. That means the exponent is smaller, and that means the probability is much, much higher. Problem is, you have to calculate then what happens for electric fields which are not constant, which is quite tough. So there's only a few examples where you can actually do that. But in these examples, it turned out one can reduce this exponent here and then thereby increase the probability quite a lot. Still, one has to be careful. If you just shine in photons from other sides too much, then you can actually climb up directly from here to there. So that you just add photon and photon and photon and climb up. So that you say add 10 photons or so and directly go from here to there, then it wouldn't be tunneling anymore. It would be just some multi-photon pair production. That's also an interesting effect, but that has been seen already. So we want to really have the tunneling here. But still, whether with these new laser fields they will be able to see it or not is a very tough question, so we just have to see. So whether there will be experiments really in the real QED vacuum is still open. But then the question is, can we have something similar, maybe in the lab, which is easier for the experimentalists to produce? And it turns out there are some examples for that. And one of them, let me show you here. But this is now a totally different story from these extremely high energies. We go now to very low energies and consider just some laser fields in the lab, which can be done in the lab. And if you make a standing laser field, then you know the electric field has some sinusoidal shape. And then if you put atoms in this standing laser field, they move like in a lattice. So the laser field makes a lattice potential for these atoms. That's depicted here with this gray sort of washboard potential. And then the little red dots are the atoms, and they jump, they move in this lattice, and can be described by such a Hamiltonian over here. That's called the Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian. Bless you. Let me just describe what's in there. So these are the creation annihilation operators for atoms at the lattice site mu or nu. So what this is basically annihilates an atom at lattice site nu and creates one at lattice site mu. So basically the atom hops from one side to the other. Here's this tunneling matrix, tells you which direction you can hop. And in front of it is some tunneling or hopping rate j. It turns out it's good for the calculation to factor out this coordination number, which tells you how many neighbors you have, but it's not so important here. So then the atoms sort of tunnel through the lattice. But in addition to it, if you have two atoms at the same side, they repel each other, and there the repulsion energy is u. So if you have two atoms at the same side, you have to pay the induction penalty, and that's just this u. And this is the Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian giving you these two effects. And that's sort of very innocently looking, but it's already too hard to solve. So you cannot solve this one exactly, but we already know quite a lot about it. If the hopping J dominates, then we are in the superfluid phase. That means the hopping is much stronger than the interaction, and the atoms can sort of hop freely over the lattice. And then basically they make a Bose condensate, and you have a superfluid. So they sort of move around easily. Whereas on the other hand, if the interaction is much stronger, then they are pinned to their sides. They cannot move again. They cannot move anymore. And that's then what is called the mod insulator state. So there you have exactly, or to good approximation, exactly one atom per lattice side. And in this case, if you want to move them around, you have to pay some energy. So it's not so easy. You cannot just move them. You have to pay basically an energy gap if you want to take this atom and put it somewhere else. And that's the state we are interested in. And now let's see what happens if we take this state. And now I'll take our lattice and tilt it a bit.
This is the filling factor of one.
Yes, yeah, in a mod state, you can also have filling factor of two, but here I'm considering filling factor of one, yeah. If there wouldn't be a filling factor of one, then you could, would be still be able to move around, yeah. Okay. So now let's do a little tilt. And then if you tilt the whole thing, that basically means that you give these different lattice sites now different energies. So you have an additional term here in the Hamiltonian. This is the potential, and this is just the number at that lattice site mu. So here's the lattice without tilt. And then if I tilt it, it looks like this. So without tilt, you have here all these atoms in the minima. And if you want to take this atom out and put it over there, you have to pay this energy penalty from the interaction. So you have to pay some, put some energy in to make an excitation. But now let's look what happens if I tilt the whole thing. Then if I take the atom here and put it over there, way to the left, and go far enough to the left, then you see from the lattice tilt, you gain enough energy to overcome the gap over here. And then it should be able to do it without additional energy. And then if you look at this picture and compare it to the picture here, that's again the Dirac C. And Dirac C with tilt, you see it looks very much the same. There's very, very similarity between this QED tunneling effect and the tunneling in these optic lattices. And it turns out it's not just a picture, it's really the equation. It turns out the equations of motion are very, very similar. To prove that, that is just not a picture, let me show a few steps of the very few steps of the derivation. So here we have our lattice. And now I introduce some operators, some particle operator, which goes from two atoms at the lattice site mu to one atom. So it would go from this double occupied to, say, a single occupation. Or a hole operator, which goes from one atom to zero atoms. And then, very similar to what we do in field theory, I write down an effective scalar field, which is just the sum of these two particle and hole operators. And then try to see how this behaves under the Hamiltonian, do a lot of steps, a lot of calculations. And at the end, what you get is that this scalar field here, the wave equation it obeys, looks like this. So you have time derivative, the potential, which is basically just the lattice tilt squared. And then here are some spatial derivatives. So no spatial derivative, second order, fourth order, and so on. And now if you say, okay, if I look at very long wavelengths, that is the stuff varies very smoothly, I can neglect these higher orders and just look at that. And then if you look here, if you look at this equation, you see that looks exactly like the Klein-Fock-Gordon equation you know from relativistic quantum field theory, where I identify this energy gap here, the mass squared times effective speed of light squared, with the energy gap we know from the Bose-Hubbard model that can be calculated from the Hamiltonian. I just give you the expression here. So basically, this energy gap in the Bose-Hubbard model corresponds up to a factor of two, or basically with this factor of two, to this energy gap here between the lower and the upper minimum in the real QED case. And also, the effective speed of light is a bit smaller. Of course, the atoms don't move with the speed of light. They move much, much, much slower. But apart from this replacement, it's really the same equation. And then we can use this nice quote by Richard Feynman saying the same equations have the same solutions. So if we have this Schwinger tunneling over here in the real QED case, we should also have the Sauter Schwinger tunneling here for our atoms in these lattice sites, in this optical lattice. And here, for these atoms, the main advantage is this. The energy gap is much smaller than in the real QED case. And also the speed of light, or this effective propagation speed, is much, much smaller. So the effect should be much, much easier to see, in principle. OK, let me just wrap this up about the dictionary. So what is how should I translate between the real QED case, where you have the Sauter-Schwinger effect, and these atoms in optical lattices given by the Bose-Hubbard model. So in QED, you have electrons and positrons, whereas in the Bose-Hubbard model, these are replaced by these particle and hole excitation. So particle means you have two atoms at a site, and hole means you have no atom. This Dirac C, you know from QED, is here replaced by the mod state, which basically is a state where we have exactly one atom per site. Sorry. And the mass of these electrons or positrons is now replaced by this energy gap. And the role of the electric field in the QED case is now played by a lattice tilt, which tries to move the atoms. And instead of the speed of light, we have here some effective velocity, C effective, which is much, much smaller. And therefore, in principle, the experimentalists should be able to see this. There are also some other ideas around, but I think let me just discuss this and then go on to the Hawking case, unless there are some questions for the Schwinger effect. Oh, sorry, I forgot to mention this. Yeah, and the point is for the Dirac C construction, there you need there are fermions. Here I have made this mapping to bosons, but the point is the Schwinger effect also occurs for bosons in the same way. If you really do this concretely and look what kind of statistics this fulfills, this is sort of a tricky question. It's not really a fermion. It's also not really a boson. It's sort of a funny quasi particle. But the if you just look at, say, the usual mixing, positive and negative energies and so on, that's exactly the same. So that works here as well.
The other question, what is the lattice, what do you actually do to produce this lattice tilt?
Experimentally. I mean, usually you have neutral atoms. So one thing is to just take gravity. So really have gravity or accelerate the whole lattice that you have the acceleration. Force. You may also try some other electric or magnetic forces, but I think these are the two which they mainly use, which already shows you that the energy scales for these optic lattices are much, much weaker, that you can sort of get away with that. Or another point would be, the other point would be that you have always some additional parabolic potential, and that basically also plays the role of some electric field. So it depends what you want to do, but these tilts, lattice tilts and so on, that already has been done. For example, if you have not the mod state, but some free atoms, then you have these Bloch oscillations in the lattice, so they can't move down forever since the kinetic energy is bounded. So then the atoms in the lattice will oscillate back and forth. This has already been seen. So there's a lot of experimental know-how in these cases. Here for this experiment, we are still in contact with experimental groups trying to convince them to do this. So far, I haven't seen any experiments who tried to attempt that. But I spoke with several people and said they should be able to do this. But other things like a simulation of such a field equation, but with a PEC without the mod state, that already has been achieved. As far as I know, has not been seen yet. There is, if you make the tilt very, very large, that basically just one hopping over one lattice side is enough, then it's not quite the same as here. But this has been experimentally done. To make the huge tilt that you just hop over one lattice side, that has been done. I think by Bloch or I think in the Bloch group.
Then they
tilted the lattice, and exactly where you have that the lattice tilt is such that over one lattice side you gain exactly this energy, then the current is large, and if it's a bit smaller then is no current, and if it's too large then it's also different. So this has been seen.
But that
is sort of pair creation, but it's not in this regime, since here we want to have a sort of weak lattice tilt that you have to tunnel over many or sufficiently many lattice sides.
Yeah, I'm confused. But don't you want to see holes moving in the other direction somehow?
Yeah, it depends on what they can see. I mean, the Bloch and wait a minute. Some groups are really able to actually monitor the atoms that you see. Oh, look, there are two atoms, or there is no atom.
Yeah.
But not all of them. And other groups, they can just measure. Oh, look, we do something, and then there are atoms coming out on this side. Uh-huh. This is my very rough theory, picture of it, but some groups are actually really, really able to look at the thing and see, look, here there are always just one atom, but here there is no atom. Mm-hmm. And in their case, if there are two atoms at the same side, then they make some reaction and then they are gone, so they cannot distinguish between two and zero atoms. but they can distinguish between one and an even odd number. Uh-huh. So that's basically
then
enough
the
for
QED
us.
The QED effect, there would be sort of a current of electrons going one way and a current
and,
of
yes.
positrons going. I'm just wondering if there's some way one could.
Would be nice, but I think with the techniques now, it's probably you can only see, oh, look, there is something here. And at the same time, it would be such a pretty coincidence, yes, it's something here. That would be the signature. That is always a pair, what you create. OK, so then let me go on and go with, oh, sorry, to Hawking radiation, which probably most of you will be more familiar than the Schwinger-Sauter-Schwinger effect. So let me just give you a very rough sketch or remind you how it works. So here, this is the space-time diagram of the collapse of a black hole. So time goes up, radius goes to the side, and I'm assuming spherical symmetry. So here we have surface of some star or something which collapses towards the singularity. And these red lines, these are light rays. So you know if the gravitational field is weak, the light rays just go at 45 degrees. But if the gravitational field becomes stronger, then they are bent. And at some point, it becomes so strong that they are bent extremely strongly. And if it's really strong enough, then they are crashed back to the singularity. And the borderline between sort of the last light ray, which is still able to escape, and the first light ray, which crashes, is trapped and crashes back to the singularity, this border, this blue curve here, that's the event horizon, which then forms. So this is just a classic picture of a black hole. And now what Hawking did is to say, on this classical background, let's take some quantum fields, like quantum electrodynamics, and start off in a vacuum state over here, and then look what happens. And what he found is that if you start off in a vacuum field, a vacuum state here, and then look at what comes out over there, then it's not a vacuum anymore, but it's an excited state, and the excitation is such that it looks like a thermal state given by the Hawking temperature, which is plotted here. Unfortunately, it's 1 over mass squared and then h bar in the denominator, so it's an extremely tiny effect and probably not possible to see for a real large black hole out there, but still is very interesting for quantum gravity point of view and then the final state of black holes and so on and so forth. The entropy and the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, that's all based on this effect. And I think a nice picture to view this is to say, okay, initially, this state here can be compared to the quantum state of two coupled harmonic oscillators, sketched in this very rough picture over here. So you know, if you have two coupled harmonic oscillators, the ground state is actually some entangled state due to the coupling. Now, if the wave packet moves, then slow, then the spring constants and coupling and so on changes slowly. But if it changes slowly, these coupled pair of harmonic oscillators stays in the ground state. But at some point, these modes are ripped apart. One goes this way and the other one goes that way. And then the coupling must vanish. And that happens in a non-adiabatic way. So imagine just taking a scissor and cutting the string over here. And if you do this, then you have initially some ground state of a coupled harmonic oscillator. Then the coupling is gone. And what you end up with is an excited state of each of these oscillators, but they are entangled. So they are correlated between the two. And this part sort of goes over here. This part falls in. And that is sort of a picture of this Hawking process. So the whole state is still a pure state. But if you just look at one of these oscillators, so just look at the stuff which comes out here, then it's a mixed state. And that can give you this thermality. So the thermal state is a mixed state, but the whole thing is still pure. And the way it works is that you only look at part of the stuff. That's all very nice. But as Bill has pointed out many times, there's a problem. If you just take a usual Hawking particle over here and trace it back in time, and the black hole lasts long enough, then the initial modes have such a small wave number that you wouldn't believe quantum field theory at that point anymore. So there are some problem with the derivation. And actually, these analogs is one way to attack this question. OK, so we can't see this for a real black hole unless in the LHC they produce these tiny black holes. But you know, there's, yeah. maybe not so likely that they do that, but maybe it will work. But if they don't, we can still do something. That is, look at some analog of these black holes in the lab. This has been proposed also by Bill. Here's this nice paper. And let me just give you some example how the thing could work. So here, let's look at some De Laval nozzle. So here, the black one are the walls of this nozzle. These green stuff, these are streamlines, so you have some fluid coming in here. And here, the fluid is slower than the speed of sound in the fluid, the flow. So then the nozzle becomes narrower, so the flow speeds up, as you would expect. If you put enough pressure, then here, at the narrowest point, it just exceeds the speed of sound. And then the sort of strange thing is, if the nozzle becomes wider again, then a bit contrary to intuition, the flow speeds up even further. So it exits the nozzle with supersonic speed and has subsonic speed at the entrance. That just comes out of the Euler equation. It's a sort of the idea of these De Laval nozzles. So now let's see what happens to the sound rays in this fluid. So you put a little speaker in here and emit sound, then you see this should be these red arrows. Sound is moving in all directions. It's a bit dragged with the flow, but it's still able to come out. However, if I put a speaker here, then you see the flow goes flows, the fluid flows by so fast that it drags all the sound with it. So the sound cannot make it in this direction, and everything is dragged in this direction. And here, this is this Mach cone. You probably also know from these supersonic planes or something. And here, at that point, if you emit sound over here, then you see just at that point, it's trying to come out. But the fluid has the same speed in this direction, so it's basically standing still. And in other directions, it is sort of then dragged away. So now I see this. If you say this one is very similar to the outside of a black hole, and this one here would be similar to the inside, so then this point where the sound speed and the flow velocity coincide is similar to this black hole horizon. And it turns out that's this nice point in this picture, in this paper. That's just not a it's not just a nice picture. It really, you can show that the equations for sound and the equations for light in the black hole background are the same. So really, you have the same equations. And then again, quoting Mr. Feynman here, then you would have the same solutions. That means if this black hole gives off Hawking radiation, then also such a nozzle should give off Hawking radiation. That means you should have some sound moving in this direction. Now, if you do the same sort of similar calculation as Hawking did, you get an effective Hawking temperature for this system. And it depends, again, you have h bar and Boltzmann constant, but it mainly depends on the gradient of the velocity at the horizon. And if you plug in some numbers, you see the temperature is probably going to be quite low, depending on what system you're looking at, but still much, much higher than for a real black hole, so much easier to see. Now the point would be A, can we do experiments? And B, can we use such a nice analog to get some toy model for quantum gravity and maybe to see what happens to this transplanting problem? So for black holes, if we take some outgoing Hawking wave here, trace it back in time, and it comes from extremely short wavelength modes, and at some point you get you don't believe it anymore that the theory works at such tiny scales. So what happens here in the black in these analogs? And the way it works here is for these fluids, if you consider sound waves as very, very short wavelengths, then at some point typically the dispersion relation changes. So they are no longer moving with the speed of sound, but they are slower or faster. That's what happens in almost all condensed matter systems. And here I'm considering, say, a Bose-Einstein condensate, where a wave with very short wavelengths is actually faster than the usual speed of sound. And then how this Hawking radiation works is you have this initial wave packet over here with very short wavelengths, and it's moving faster, so it can actually move in this direction. So it's propagating against the flow. And during this propagation, it is stretched, since you see the flow velocity at the rear end is larger than at the front end, so the the sound is stretched all the way until it comes to the horizon. And here, if it's here stretched enough, then this part notices, oh, I can escape. Whereas this part feels, oh, I'm not fast enough, so I have to go in this direction. So at the end, this wave packet is then ripped apart into one part which goes outside, one part which goes inside. And then you have exactly the same picture with these coupled harmonic oscillators. So here they are in the ground state. Then it's propagating, still in the ground state. But then if they're ripped apart, it's like cutting the spring here. And then you have this entangled state. And you can do the same calculation with dispersion. I also spare you all the details. And it turns out under suitable assumptions, what comes out here is really has this Hawking temperature. Even though if you trace it back in time, you don't end up with extremely short wavelengths. They are short, but they are not so short that we don't know what's going on anymore. The point is here, for these systems, you really have Hawking radiation, and you really know where it comes from. For real black hole, it's still not so clear how to do the calculations. Okay. Another point, let me just mention this as well, is instead of moving the flow through the nozzle or something, is instead having the medium at rest and moving some pulse through the medium. This is probably a good idea if you want to do the whole thing with light. So let's assume we have some nonlinear dielectric medium, and then we send a strong light pulse through the medium. And if the medium is nonlinear, that means where the light pulse is, the index of refraction is increased a bit. So here's the index of refraction, here's x, and assume this light pulse moves through the medium with some velocity v. Now, if you adjust this velocity v correctly, that is that the light in the medium outside the pulse, so just the unperturbed medium, is faster than the pulse. But then when the pulse comes, index of refraction is higher. That means the speed of light in the medium is lower. It's below the pulse speed. And outside is again higher than the pulse speed. If you do this fine-tuning, then you see if you're co-moving with the pulse through the medium, then what you see is this pulse, or the pulse is at rest, but the medium is sort of moving by. And then if you look at a photon just outside the pulse, you see the photon is a bit faster than your velocity, so they can just escape. Whereas the photon inside the pulse, they are slower than you, so you see them fall behind. So they are trying to escape, but they can't make it. So that means this point here, where the pulse speed is just equal to the light velocity, that's the same as this horizon, the black hole horizon. There's also another point where you have where it comes back again. That would be equivalent to a white hole horizon. That's also quite interesting. I'm not talking about this at the moment. And then you can do it. This is not just a picture. You can do all the equations of motion. And again, under suitable assumptions, you find that you have the same equations as here for the black hole case. So it would also say you have Hawking radiation. That means you would have some photons moving in this way, so just sort of running away from the pulse, which gives you this Hawking radiation. And for light, the point is this speed can be much, much higher, so the temperatures you can reach are much, much higher, so it could be easier to see. There has been recently some paper where they claim, the authors claim, they saw something like Hawking radiation with these pulses. And of course, that has created quite a big splash. But unfortunately, here's one of the papers which discussed this problem. If you really look at the experiment and try to insert all the equations and all the orders of magnitude, it doesn't quite work out. But it's still a very nice experiment, so it might be one idea to actually see Hawking radiation in the lab. But unfortunately, so far, they are not quite there yet. Yeah, let's say this is still, they saw some experiment, they saw some photons, and we are still discussing or trying to find out what they saw, but the Hawking, it doesn't quite fit with the Hawking picture yet. So let's just say this. Okay, so now maybe first, are there questions for the Hawking radiation?
So what did this recent experiment actually do?
They did something like that. So they sent a pulse through the medium.
What is the medium?
It was non silica. No, sorry. Fused silica.
Which
So silica glass. And they send such a pulse through the medium and increased this delta N a bit in such a way that it worked out. Problem there was that in these, so here I totally neglected dispersion. So there, I didn't say speed of light at that frequency or that frequency. So I just said speed of light. In the experiment, dispersion was quite strong. So we had different between group and phase velocities. So that already made the thing more complicated. And then they saw photons coming out this way. Whereas Hawking radiation, you would expect photons going this way. So that was also one of our points. But in the meanwhile, the authors say that maybe there was some scattering. So the photons were actually produced this way and then scattered. That could solve some of the problems, but not all of them. So there were some open questions to that. And also, if you just take this equation here and just say, okay, I have speed of light, I know what it is, I know how it changes, and so on, calculate the Hawking temperature, then it didn't quite work with the energy and the photons they saw.
It was too low, the Hawking temperature was too low, is that?
The Hawking temperature was too low to explain the number and the energy of the photons as they described. Now again, if you say you have some scattering, then you have to redo some of the calculations, so you don't say it comes out this way, but it comes out this and then it's scattered. But still, I think it's fair to say it's not clear what they actually observed and how close it is related to this Hawking radiation. But if you just take their experiment, take their numbers and say, can it be Hawking radiation, and plug it in, they say, yeah, no, that doesn't work.
Is it like an order of magnitude?
Oh, no, about a couple of orders of magnitude. Not just one.
But scattering, it
would
be hard to scatter.
The point is with these, not just now what the experimentalists said, if you have this huge laser and they are sort of not at the intensity where the medium is damaged, but a bit below it, but not too far. So if such a strong laser goes through the medium, then you also make little cracks and little defects and so on. So yeah, it's still not clear. I mean, it would be, in order to explain this by scattering, you would need some significant scattering. That's true, but yeah, I don't know whether this is realistic or not. But they are looking into this now. They are trying to redo the experiment and really looking what is going on and how much scattering there is and so on. It would be probably interesting to keep up with this. Further questions? Oh, okay. So then let's come to the last three effects, but very briefly. So this is now Bill's effect, the Unruh effect. And that's a bit related to Hawking radiation, but you can explain it without reference. And the point is the following. If you just take the usual Minkowski vacuum and then put a particle detector, so let's assume this piece of chalk would be a photodetector. If you put this into the vacuum, then of course it doesn't click since there's no photons in the vacuum. If you move this detector with a constant speed through the vacuum, you know Minkowski vacuum is Lorentz invariant, so it still doesn't click. But if you take this detector and wiggle it around, shake it around, then it could click, picture changes, and that's the point of the Unruh effect. So if you say, for example, take a constant acceleration A, this detector would click as if it was immersed in a thermal bath with this temperature, which is proportional to the acceleration, but here is h bar and c. And then if you set in some everyday accelerations, you see this temperature is so low that there's no way to see it for everyday accelerations. But you could say, okay, let's look at an electron. If we now accelerate an electron in a strong laser beam, then you can have much, much higher accelerations. Can we see that? Or can we maybe use that? But the problem is such an electron is not the same as a particle detector. It's just an electron. Yeah. So let's assume we have this electron here. This is supposed to be the blue dot. It's strongly accelerated. So now if you sit on the electron and observe the vacuum, what you would see is a thermal bath of photons with this temperature. But now what the electron can do is interact with these photons. So you know a little electron, if there's a photon coming, it could scatter them, just by the usual Thompson or Compton scattering. So what would you say? Okay, I have the electron here, my thermal bath of photons around. So it could happen that one of these photons here from the thermal bath is scattered at my electron. And then the question is, what would an observer in the lab in the laboratory frame C, since you cannot co-move, with the electrons, it's just too hard. So what would you see if you look at this from the outside? And the point is the scattering. So first you change this thermal bath, since this photon is taken away from this mode. So if the electron wasn't there, then this photon would just go do this. Now the electron is here, so this photon is gone, and a new photon is emitted in here. So we have two changes of this thermal bath. But the thermal bath, if you go back to the lab frame, that's just a vacuum. And the only way to change the vacuum, you cannot take away photons, this is the vacuum, is only that to add a photon. So this one here corresponds to the emission of one photon, and the other change here corresponds to the emission of another photon. That's also sort of in this paper over there. So in the lab frame, what you see is that the electron emits a pair of entangled photons due to the acceleration. So you have the quantum vacuum fluctuations, and then the electron comes, kicks them, and emits a pair of entangled photons, and they, in principle, could be seen. For example, if you have electrons in a strong laser field, yes, if you do then the calculations, you see there could be a possibility to observe actually these entangled photons or to create them. Problem is to observe them is a bit tough, since this electron, you know, if you have an accelerated electron, it also emits classical radiation like mad, so then you have to distinguish this little pair of quantum photons from the whole classical background, but in principle there are some ideas to do this. Then, as announced, this dynamical Casimir effect. So here's the usual picture you see. Here are the two ideal plates, neutral. And here are the modes filling up the vacuum. And the point is, in between the two mirrors, the vacuum is a bit different from the outside. And then if you do the calculations, then that means the two plates attract if they are both, say, of the same kind. Usually, or sometimes you hear this argument, there are in between the two plates, there are less modes than outside. That's why the pressure in between is less than outside. But this argument is a bit dangerous. For example, if you take one plate with Neumann boundary conditions and the other one with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So it looks like, how can we do this? So if you have the two plates here, so usually if they are the same, then you would have, say, Dirichlet and Wolf plates like that. But if you have Dirichlet and one and Neumann and the other, the modes look like that. So here's zero and here the derivative is zero. And then in such a situation, actually they would repel each other. So the argument with less modes, thereby less pressure, is not quite correct. Unfortunately, this Casimir repulsion to do it in vacuum is quite tough since we don't have a plate with Neumann and boundary conditions, so we only have plates with both Dirichlet. We don't have two plates which has the opposite boundary conditions. That's very hard to do. Yeah, anyway, now if we move one of these two plates, then you can actually create photon pairs out of the vacuum. And that is what usually is called this dynamical Casimir effect. And you can have some cavity that is two plates, and then you can even have some resonance effects. But the point is, it also works with just one mirror. If you just have one mirror and wiggle this around, then also you would create pairs of photons. But this effect is very hard to see. And here in this experiment, what they did is to say, okay, we don't take the vacuum. We just take a one-dimensional waveguide for microwaves. And that's in the ground state that looks like the vacuum. And then here, instead of mirror, which is moving, they had some reflecting boundary conditions, and they changed the reflection. So they moved a little bit between Neumann and Dirichlet back and forth in a time-dependent manner. With microwaves, that's possible. And that sort of looks like moving the mirror. And then they could really see entangled pairs of microwave photons coming out. So this is a very, very interesting experiment. It's not the exact Casimir effect with vacuum and plates, but it's, I think, a very interesting thing. But now you can see, okay, if I have this one plate here moving around, and I have this one electron here moving around, which I just explained to you for the Unruh effect, isn't that the same? And then you would say, yeah, there is some relation. So if you say, okay, I forget that's an electron, I just take a little spherical mirror and move this around. And they would say, yeah, this is dynamical Casimir effect, but with this argument, you could also say there's some signature of the Unruh effect. So there is some relation between the two. And once you go away from the original setup, it's sometimes hard to distinguish whether it's signatures of the Unruh effect or just dynamical Casimir effect. So So one should be a bit careful what kind of words to use. But I think these effects are all quite interesting. And once we see one, it's maybe not so important whether it's more Casimir or more Unruh. It's just an interesting fundamental effect and has relations to different areas. OK. Oh, some more questions for this one? Oh, then let's come to my last example. That is cosmology particle creation. And there you have the initial vacuum. And now the universe expands and rips apart the vacuum. And then you also create pairs of particles. And as I told you, if our present model of cosmology is correct, you can still see traces of this effect in the cosmic microwave background. Since during inflation, you had really a huge expansion. Right now, the expansion is not so fast. So you probably won't see anything from the expansion right now. But during inflation, it was really a huge Hubble parameter. And there you could actually see something. So how to see this in the lab? And here the idea would be, for example, if you take some ion chain. So that's an experimental picture. Here, these are ions. And they are trapped in vacuum in a little ion trap. And the point with these systems is the experimentalists are very clever. They can actually cool down this ion chain down to the ground state. That is, with more than 90% probability, you can say there's no phonon in there. It's really the ground state. That's what they can do. And that's also very interesting for quantum information applications. But here, I just take it for the expanding universe. And the point is, if you now look at these ions, they repel each other. So they all interact. And then you can imagine you have some oscillations in these ion chains. So you have phonon modes in there. And if you look at the equation of motions of these phonon modes, these sound waves in this one-dimensional ion chain, they are exactly the same as the equation for quantum fields in an expanding universe if the ion chain is sort of expanding or contracting. So I really have the same equations. Then with Feynman, we have the same solutions. So if you now take this ion trap, this ion chain in the ground state, which the experimentalists can do, and then sort of let it expand rapidly and then compress it again, then after that, there should be phonons inside this ion chain, and more precisely, pairs of phonons. In this cosmological particle creation always creates pairs of particles. Here would be pairs of phonons. And again, the nice thing is they can really see whether there is one, zero, or whether there are zero, one, or two phonons. So here, that is some picture of what the experimentalists told me they can do. So here is the probability for have no phonon, one phonon, two phonons, and so on. And that's the initial state. So that's what they can do. So with more than 90% probability, there's no phonon, and a little bit probability for one phonon, and for two, it's already negligible. Now you do this, you change with the ion, the change of the trap, so the ion chain expands and recontracts. And then, that's now theory, if you started with this state, did the expansion and contraction here, then your probabilities would look like this. So you have still high probability for no phonons. This one is basically the same as the initial one. But now there's a large probability for two phonons, a little bit for three, and again, larger for four. And the point is, OK, zero phonons is the same as before. Wouldn't it be interesting? But the experimentalists can distinguish this. They can say, OK, there are two phonons, or no, there's just one phonon. And the fact that this probability is higher than this one is a nice signature of a quantum effect. If you just have heating or anything, then usually this probability would be higher than this one. But now if the probability for two phonons is higher, it would say, this is some squeezing effect. So this is really a quantum effect we have seen. So in principle, in this way, you could then be not sure, but you get a strong signature that you actually see a quantum effect. OK, so that brings me to my summary. So I showed you a couple of these fundamental effects of quantum fields. So first was the Sauter-Schwinger effect, which in the original case is with electrons and positrons in a strong electric field. And you can see something similar with these atoms in optical lattices. Second one was Hawking radiation, which is originally the evaporation of black holes. But hopefully we can see something similar with fluids going from subsonic to supersonic, or maybe with these electric pulses. And then the other three examples, we are the Unruh effect, where I might be able to see signatures with these electrons. But as I should also say that's not the only idea. There are other ideas around to connect to some condensed matter, to some laboratory systems. Dynamical Casimir effect with these two mirrors. That's sort of similar to here, that have some scattering, which is sort of changing around, wiggling around, or just behaving in a time-dependent manner. And final example was cosmological particle creation. And that can be, the analog of that can be seen, hopefully, in ion traps. Okay, so I think that's what I wanted to say now. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Do you have questions?
So on the cosmological particle creation, so you can turn it to inflation. Mm-hmm. Of course, there would be particle creation with or without inflation as long as you had a dynamical scale factor.
Yes. Yeah.
That seems to be the analog. The inflation, I'm wondering, there's a difference. I'm not sure how important it is, but in the case of inflation, you start with the inflaton far from its zero. In other words, the main reason that you see something is because the inflaton.
Okay, no, there's two things. So
here the
classical part of the inflaton field is then split into a classical part, which is slowly starting from some value up there and going down. But here, this cosmological particle creation would be the quantum fluctuations. So the inflaton part is, say, almost spatially homogeneous,
yeah.
But what I'm interested in are space-time fluctuations on top of this classical background, and that would then be the analog to this cosmological particle creation. So you say initially they are in the ground state, but then at some point they are stretched, and then they feel that they feel the horizon cannot move or cannot respond anymore, so it's like this cutting the spring, and then they are squeezed. So that this is squeezing of these quantum fluctuations, not the classical background.
Uh-huh. But I'm still unsure. Well, two questions. Is that squeezing observed in any sense in the CMB? And second of all, it still seems to me the analogy is not perfect, because I think what you're detecting is changes in energy density.
Sure.
And there are sort of cross terms between the non-zero background and linear order as opposed to quadratic order. I'm not sure it's an essential distinction.
The point is first question, is the squeezing? So can you really, let me first. Zeros, there's a lot of physics between the CMB VC and the original cosmological particle creation. That, of course, there's a lot of in between which distorts the whole thing. So can one really see, the idea is that this scale invariant spectrum, that fits very much to this picture of this cosmological squeezing. And can you really see squeezing?
The bumps in the bumps in the CMB spectrum are exactly from squeezing.
Yeah, but the question is whether you can see squeezing in the sense that you can really say that was entangled.
I'm saying those bumps are the consequence of squeezing.
Okay,
the reason
they
don't go to zero, I mean, there's a huge squeezing. The reason they don't go to zero is because the last scattering surface is finite thickness. So that smears out the peaks a little bit as well, but more importantly, it smears out the zeros. So that's why when you look at the spectrum of the CMB, you see these bumps and wiggles that get smaller. And that's precisely squeezing.
Yeah, okay. As we understand it, is explained with this squeezing. Yeah.
But you're not, are you seeing, let me think about it.
If you just take classical inflation, just classical fields, no quantum fluctuation at all, then to our understanding, you wouldn't get these wiggles. So the origin from these guys
I thought all that was captured in scale invariant spectrum of density, primordial density fluctuations, all the bumps and wiggles and so on.
No, but that's something else again. I mean, so you have the initial spectrum, and then you basically squeeze it, and you take the photograph of the squeezing.
Are you talking about the squeezing subsequent to the production of the initial spectrum?
No, before the
cheese. We're talking about before or after?
Yeah, before.
Well, but the same thing goes, I mean, it's going on all the time. This is.
Well, is it not true that you put in a scale invariant spectrum density fluctuations at some
point? Yeah, but where, the point, where does it come from?
That's from, a different question. Yeah,
this is exactly the point. Where does it come from?
So you're
from?
Just saying you can translate. Yes, of course, but there's a question where it comes from.
Yeah, but
it is not true that no matter where it came from, as long as it produced that kind of spectrum.
Fine, but the point is, in this picture, this cosmological particle creation is where this spectrum comes from.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, not this. That's a picture. As you said, that depends on a particular scenario.
It's pretty robust. I mean, as long as H is sort of reasonably constant.
No, I don't mean that. I mean,
no.
There might be other reasons to get a scale invariant spectrum that has nothing to do with inflatons. That you said yourself.
Yeah. No. This is, if you assume that there's inflation and all these steps, then these wiggles in this picture come from this cosmological particle creation effect. If you say no.
That's right, but
inflation didn't happen and I have a totally different model, then you can probably come up with
when
other.
When you talked about squeezing here, you pointed out that it sort of corresponds to pairs. You gave you the graph of not seeing odd numbers as much as seeing
Yeah, but the point is
even numbers.
In the CMB, you don't see the...
Is there some analog of that in the CMB?
That you want to really see that it's pairs of inflaton particles. Since you don't, I mean, the point is in the CMB, you only see sort of you have at the end the sort of value of your inflaton field with the fluctuations, and that's what you observe via this temperature. So you don't observe really single inflaton particles,
no.
At least here not. So, I don't see that you could say, oh, look, there's always pairs of inflaton particles from this and this feature. So I don't kind of think of a feature which really says you that this is always pairs. I don't know, Bill, do you have an idea? Or?
Well, as I said, those bumps are precisely that. And
if you
watch the thing through time, you find that the density fluctuations, if you will, capture one of the phases. They're like the q rather than the momentum, q squared rather than p squared. So as the squeeze state rotates, as a harmonic oscillator always will, sometimes you'll see the q and sometimes you'll see the p. The p is tiny, the q is big, and so that what. And since you're looking at all of these things at a specific time after the end of, I mean, at a specific time, you catch these various modes and various stages of their rotation. And that gives you those bumps and wiggles. And the fact that p squared is almost zero and q squared is large is reflected in, can be described in terms of even number of particles in these states. It's a squeeze state, which is a state with an even number of particles in it. Mm-hmm. So the two are very closely linked to each other.
Would you rule out that there could be a more classical origin of the
spectrum? I always have trouble with this because you know, the quantum effect and the classical effect are precisely the same effect.
No, I meant something completely different from inflation.
Sorry?
Something completely different from inflation.
Whether we could rule this, or whether I could rule this out? Of course not. I mean,
No, the squeezing has basically nothing to do with inflation. You don't need an inflationary regime
in order to get the squeezing.
No, the squeezing not, but the scale invariant spectrum, there you want that H, the Hubble is Hubble parameter is constant over a reasonably long time. That's what. Also, sure. That's the explanation here. If maybe you can come up with something else, could be possible as well. But if you take this cosmological particle creation and do some funny expansion which is not De Sitter like, then you would typically not get a Skillingian spectrum.
Sure.
But if you have a non-scale invariant spectrum, then you've got some place where the spectrum hits one, and you've got huge fluctuations on that scale. So the universe, for anything but a scale invariant spectrum, the universe would look incredibly different than it does now and have these structure, you know, these incredibly intense structures on some particular scale in the universe.
Oh, I'm not questioning whether scale invariance is a good...
No, all I'm saying is it's very hard to get anything that doesn't have a scale invariant spectrum, no matter what your theory of the universe is.
So that's an argument that it's not a very strong evidence for this.
Yes.
Whole. Okay.
In fact, no, sorry, are you saying the theory, in order to be okay, needs to be scale invariant, or saying the theory in itself usually gives you something scale invariant? I think the first one is...
No, I think it's probably closer to the second one, but you could probably make anthropic arguments for scale invariant spectrum, because otherwise you'd have these basically black holes sitting, the universe would be full of black holes with a certain size, and everything would be in them rather than in galaxies and planets and so forth.
Of course,
yeah.
Scale invariance was suggested long ago.
Pardon?
Of course, scale invariance was suggested long before inflation, I believe.
Yes.
For reasons must be closely related to what you just said.
Right.
Right. If you don't have more questions, we can thank...